Hello, and welcome to New World Witchery, the search for American traditional witchcraft. I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane.
If you're looking for a podcast on traditional American folk magic, we hope you'll stay tuned.
In this episode, we'll be discussing hot and cold spells.
No, not those things where you can boil a pot of water with a single glance or freeze your little brother, but instead, periods of interest waxing and waning in your witchcraft.
And how they affect our practices. And in the lore segment of our show, we'll be reading Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
So stick around. We think we've got an interesting show for you, and we'll see you on the other side of this break.
This is Meadow Moon, and you can find me at A Pagan in the Threshold, where I will be discussing mostly pagan-related topics. I'm a work-from-home homeschooling mom of two located in South Carolina. In addition to that, I'm a case manager for a local paranormal group, and I have a bachelor's degree in alternative medicine. So I think it's pretty safe to say that we'll have plenty to talk about. You can find me at meadowmoon.com and on iTunes. So I invite you to join me as I hit rewind on my pagan beliefs and start back at square one.
Looking for magical supplies that are handcrafted with natural, organic, and ethical ingredients? Visit Forest Grove Botanica, a folk magic and medicine shop for the Pacific Northwest, at forestgrovebotanica.com.
And we're back. So, yeah, we'll be discussing hot and cold spells. Let's start with the reasons for.
We'll start with defining kind of what they are.
Oh, okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. We both talked about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. We each have periods where we're intensely into our witchcraft, or we kind of let it slide for a while.
Right.
And for me, that tends to be more with individual practices like divination. I don't tend to do that as regularly as I do other things. And I think you were saying like that for you tends to be just observance.
Yeah, I'll still, you know, acknowledge. I guess that I'm a witch. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll still think about it and maybe even read about it a little bit, but, mm-hmm. you know, practicing anything or any ritual is just, I just don't really feel like it, I guess, sometimes.
It's interesting. There's, we recently had a comment on our iTunes, glowing little review from, I believe her name was Meadow Moon, and I think she runs another podcast, Pagan in the Threshold, and she did a show on what's called spiritual laziness.
Oh.
And it's interesting because I don't hear this topic addressed a lot, and I don't think hot and cold spells are quite the same thing as spiritual laziness, but I think there's a connection. You know, do we go through these spells because we can't motivate ourselves to do something, or is it because there's actually a reason that we need to take a break from it?
Right. So, what would some of those reasons be? Actually, we had a reader email us and to address, you know, asked us to address the topic. I think we'd like to read some of this.
Yes.
Let's see.
This is from, I believe it's Annika. Yes, I think that's kind of how we've decided to pronounce it. Annika, if that's incorrect, please let us know. And she writes,
let's see. For future topics, I do hope you retouch again on why Wiccans and Pagans may periodically pause in their practice. And she brings up some interesting reasons why, which we'll definitely talk about. Spiritual rest, transitioning, rejection from other religious peers, and as well discuss methods for some once practitioners to get back into the saddle again. So let's talk about those reasons for.
Okay.
The first one she brings up is recharging, which I think is definitely a reason for me.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, you know, it's sort of, since you're in a hot spell, you know, you're sort of going all the time and you're thinking about it a lot and you're using a lot of your personal energy,
mm-hmm.
you know, going towards all these different things. When you finally start to slow down a little, it's almost like a battery, you know, it's, mm-hmm. you need recharging every now and then. And, you know, and some people are able to do that through more practice,
mm-hmm.
such as like meditation or communing with the land.
So communing with the land, needing to spend more time, I think, introspectively in some cases.
Yeah. But some people just need to stop for a little while and
mm-hmm.
and not do anything at all.
So as far as the recharging goes, do you feel like there are specific times when you expend a lot of energy on witchcraft, and then specific times when you feel like you need that cocoon period, that period to draw in some energy to build yourself back up?
Definitely. I've noticed that mine goes by the seasons. And
Appropriate.
Very much so. I mean, I'll get sort of excited at the vernal equinox, you know, or some people call it Ostara. And
so what does that do for you? I know it's a period of balance. Is it during the dark time of the year, do you feel less energized to do that kind of work?
Yeah, sometimes. I don't know. It's weird. Like, when spring first starts, I mean, my whole life, you know, every aspect of it, I get excited and, you know, I want to do things. It's like spring cleaning, you know, like I'm pretty sure I have SAD, you know, seasonal affective disorder. Mm-hmm. When the sun goes away, I get a little bit depressed and, you know, I'm very like a homebody and
shut down. You're eating like Cheetos mixed with vanilla ice cream on the couch for 6 months.
Gross. But basically, yeah, you know, winter is pretty hard on me usually. Mm-hmm. This one, not as much. I'm not sure why, but anyway. But then, once it gets to be, like, true summer, like, you know, July, really hot temperatures, and where we live, it is very, very muggy.
Oh, yeah.
The humidity is insane here. So, you know, you walk outside, and it's like you're walking in soup.
Yes. You don't have to sweat. The air does it for you.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
So, then I sort of get lazy as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then once it starts turning into fall again, I sort of feel that same thing that I felt at spring. Halloween or Samhain,
mm-hmm.
I definitely start getting excited again. Because, you know, I've always sort of seen that as like the witchy new year.
Okay.
And then Yule was the first holiday I ever practiced. So I get excited mm-hmm. about that one again as well.
Mm-hmm.
But so yeah, it sort of comes and goes throughout the year. And
mm-hmm. But it's affected sort of by... It sounds like, in your case, it's affected a little bit by seasons and a little bit by climate, to some extent, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I can see that. And then, to some extent, by the holidays that are mm-hmm. being...
Yeah, it's just the ones I feel closer to, I guess, or mm-hmm. more excited about. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But what about you? Do you go through periods of recharging?
I mean, in the span of a year, I'm sort of the inverse. The dark part of the year is the part where I start kicking into high gear round about Michaelmas, which is September, is mm-hmm. Usually late September. That's the first point where I start saying, okay, I'm done with all of my gardening, I'm done with all of my summer work, I'm done with everything that comes during that part of the year, which, again, it's so muggy outside that merely walking to your car is kind of a feat of will.
Well, I'm getting in the hot car, and my car is black, it traps heat.
Oh, it's miserable.
It's so awful. But at the same time, I am yearning for it right now. It is so gross and cold and wet outside. I want the muggy.
This is my weather. I love this. I love cold weather. And don't get me wrong, I love southern weather, period. Mm-hmm. Even with the muggy, as much as I complain, it's still sort of something vindicating about hearing somebody from, you know, Arizona or Nevada saying, oh, it's so hot, and you're like, at least it's a dry heat. There's something that always feels really good about saying that.
So you're saying that you're superior.
I totally am. No, that's not true. Or my favorite thing is when somebody from the north comes down to the south and we don't warn them about the weather in advance. It's just funny.
It is funny. Especially like a Canadian or something.
Uh-huh.
That's always hilarious.
Yeah, because like on paper you look at it and you go, 92 degrees, that's bearable. Nothing's boiling at that point.
Right.
And then they actually walk outside and they turn to soup. It's just comical. So enough about the weather, though.
Yeah, anyway.
But speaking of cotton cold spells, I mean, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, with me, that dark time of the year from about Michaelmas, and I go all the way through Candlemas with my celebrations. So, you know, September through February, probably my most active time of the year for witchcraft. And that includes the holiday stuff that goes on in there. I'm very, very busy in that part of the year with different holidays, particularly in December. I've got tons of stuff that goes on in December. And then with the actual witchcraft, I feel much more connected, more likely to do divination during that time of the year.
Yeah, it's definitely more conducive to that.
And any other world workings, and more likely to try to contact spirits, things like that,
mm-hmm.
during that time of the year. And I've never had as strong a connection to the equinoxes, period. I just don't. I don't know why. I've been thinking about that a lot lately. That may be something. Maybe we'll do a show on holidays at some point.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. We're writing that one down. I've never had that strong connection to those equinoxes. And so there's this period between, the February and May that's kind of a dead zone for me. And this period between really midsummer and Michaelmas for me that's a dead zone as far as magic goes. And I don't exactly know why. I do celebrate, I celebrate Walpurgisnacht, which is sort of May Day Eve or May Eve. Mm-hmm. I celebrate that. And then I also sort of celebrate May Day, Beltane as well. And then I'll celebrate Midsummer, maybe St. John's Eve in there as well. We're just getting all holidays.
Yeah.
It might be the special on holidays anyway. But those are really the only periods of heavy activity for me, witchcraft-wise, that are not in the dark of the year. Mm-hmm. And I will do other stuff if I need to, if the need arises, but it's not something where I'm thinking of it as a practice. Not something where I'm doing it regularly.
Right.
So, yeah. So I don't know. I definitely see that there is a seasonal thing to it. But what about the tides of the years going by? Because I know we both have had these periods where we'll go for years without really practicing. I mean, we might do a small observance of a daily thing.
Mm-hmm.
But not really making a point of doing witchcraft during that year.
Well, for me, it was because I had moved from my hometown mm-hmm. and a lot of my friends because I had gotten married. And, it was fine. But, like I said before, my husband doesn't practice. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes it's a little bit awkward, mm-hmm. to be like, hey, I'm going to go light some candles and do this certain thing that he understands that I do, but he doesn't necessarily understand the reasoning behind, I guess.
Right. He accepts it because you do it, but he doesn't necessarily know why you do it.
Right. And I've tried to explain it to him, but sometimes it's just, okay, this is going to sound maybe condescending, because I've done it for a while and because it's so ingrained in me, this is why I do it. It's hard for me to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's sort of like, it's like when someone learns really high order math,
mm-hmm.
they can't teach like addition anymore, mm-hmm. or they can't learn they can't do addition anymore, just simple addition and subtraction. I've actually heard of a lot of mathematicians having a hard time with simple math. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like that. Like, I have a hard time explaining witchcraft in simple terms when I know it in such difficult terms, I guess.
Right. And there's this whole other set of baggage where you're like, I spent years trying to define it for myself,
mm-hmm.
and I've got like a Rolodex file of information on witchcraft, in my head, but I don't have time to sit here and tell whoever I'm talking to all of this information so that they will understand and be in the same mental space that I am, so
right.
I can take them through it.
Right, because it's years worth.
Yeah, it's so much stuff.
Right, so sometimes it's easier to just say, okay, just going to go light some candles.
Be like, I'm lighting some candles, I'm praying to some devil, There's a baby being sacrificed. If you hear screaming, it'll stop soon, I promise.
No.
So, no, we don't do that.
No, but, and sometimes it's easier to just not do it at all. Like sometimes I just don't mm-hmm. Sometimes I just don't feel like it.
Do you think that ties into that spiritual rest, those big gaps are periods where your spirituality kind of goes onto autopilot because other parts of your life are sort of taking precedence at that point?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I quit my job in May this past year, and
woohoo!
Yeah, it was a good thing, but at the same time, it was hard, financially, and it was, I felt like a failure, blah, blah, blah. I won't go into all my thoughts about it, but
No, the listeners are your therapist. Go for it.
But, because I was, I was worried about looking for a job and knowing the climate and worried about money and all this other stuff, it just didn't feel as important then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like a little bit depression kind of factored a little bit into it.
Yeah, so. I can see that. And then the third thing that Annika brought up was this idea of all this being a transitioning phase.
Yeah, and I think that's a really valid point. I'm really mm-hmm. glad she brought that up because I hadn't thought of that. But Well, you know, really good point.
Yeah, it absolutely is. There's sort of this thing that happens where it's like an incubation period. You've learned, I don't want to say all you can learn about some aspect of your religious or magical practice, mm-hmm. but you've gotten to a point where you've gone as far as you want to go with whatever you're studying.
Right.
You know, maybe you've gotten to where you've memorized the meanings of all the tarot cards. And yes, you could go further with that, but there's nothing in you calling to
right.
say, I need to really develop this other sense of what the tarot means and look at all these different decks.
Right.
You've reached the point that you need to be comfortable with. And so you go to this incubation period where you're not doing much with it until something sparks your interest and maybe somebody shows you a different deck that all of a sudden you're like, oh, I never thought about incorporating that meaning into the tarot.
Right.
And all of a sudden your interest, boom, comes right back.
Right.
And you learn a lot more, but you still have all that information you had. And you've moved into a new way of understanding it.
That doesn't necessarily have to just deal with, you know, a certain aspect of your workings. It can be, your entire tradition,
mm-hmm.
you know, because...
Yeah, we know that as
yeah.
well as anybody could know
that. I mean,
that.
In our transitioning period, you know, we went from British tradcraft to,
mm-hmm.
you know, to hoodoo, which is quite a big transition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, especially when... I had come from Wicca and then mm-hmm. sort of had a couple of years of a cult spell and
uh-huh.
then transitioned into tradcraft.
Yeah.
And teeny bit of, like, hedge witchery.
Yeah, yeah. There wasn't a whole lot that we did with that. That was more of an experiment, I think,
right.
than a transition. But,
Well, we worked with Hecate a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. But we certainly had this period where... You know, we did some work together, and that, I think, taught us we like working together.
Right.
But it didn't really mean anything as far as the work itself went. It was just one of those things where we felt each other out. It was comfortable. It was a good working relationship, a good partnership, magically.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a whole lot that we were doing other than sort of a seasonal observance.
Right.
But then, once we figured out that we could add this new component in, we both just... I feel like we both kind of just rocketed forward.
Yeah, I agree. I learned a lot
places.
In a really short amount of time.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it was astounding.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, sorry, it's kind of vague, but I feel like if we go too much into it, it'll be like a really long episode. But yeah, hopefully we'll talk about more about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about probably paths and branches and things
yes,
like that
like,
at some point.
Yeah, like when we get into hoodoo, maybe we can talk a lot more about that.
Yeah, that transition was definitely an interesting transition. It was a good transition.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. But,
anyway,
mm-hmm.
So can you think of any other reasons for the hot and cold spells?
Well, I mean, there is, of course, that aspect of spiritual laziness. And I know I have been guilty of that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm just a lazy person in general, so I hate to admit that, but I am, so.
It's all those Cheetos and vanilla ice cream you're eating.
Oh, just the thought of that. So nasty.
If you need to, you can add chocolate sauce to it. It's delicious. It's like Mexican fried ice cream with cheese.
Cheetos is not real cheese.
It's like Mexican fried ice cream with Dorito sauce. I don't know.
I could do that.
Oh, it's awful. Okay. So, yeah, there's that spiritual laziness,
mm-hmm.
I think, that comes into it. And, you know, that happens. People get lazy. Life happens at you rather than with you sometimes.
Right.
So in that situation, I think the key is, in my opinion, the complacency with laziness. If you don't recognize you're being lazy, this is going to sound really weird. If you don't recognize that you're being lazy... then it's kind of okay that you're being lazy.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you recognize that you're being spiritually lazy, I think that it's sort of incumbent upon you to at least figure out how you're going to get out of that.
See, I would disagree slightly. I
okay.
think it would...
No, you cannot! I am right!
I think it would be important to figure out why you're being a little lazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, depending on the reason... say, okay, well, I can be a little bit lazy for a little while longer,
mm-hmm.
or
right.
then move on from there.
Right, and that's kind of what I mean by figuring out how you're going to get out of it. If you can address that, you know, I'm being spiritually lazy because right now I don't have a job, and,
right,
and so I don't have a job, therefore I need to expend my energy on finding a job or figuring out what I'm going to do with myself. But you know that, okay, so as soon as I get a job, I need to look at my spirituality again.
Right.
And I can't just let, you know, when I get a job, I can't say, oh, now I have a job and I don't have time for spirituality. Right. I don't have time for magic.
Well, you know, and some people just sort of drift away from it, though, which is another thing to look at.
And that's a whole, that's a whole other side of this.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like the extended for life cold spell.
Yeah.
You know, some people just, it's not important to practice anymore. It's just, you know, like they believe what they believe. You know, it's not really in them to
do things.
Yeah.
In that situation, I don't know. I think that practice is really important with magic.
I agree.
But I can also understand the point of not doing anything unless you need to. And I don't personally do that. I'll do magic at the drop of a hat just because I want to practice it. I want to do it. You know, sometimes I do it for one thing and get another. So. Yeah.
See, I'm a little bit more held back. Like I haven't done a personal spell in a really long time. You know, like we've done a few, like the you know the hex that we did and the job finding. You know, we've done a witch bottle and you know we've done a few things like that. But
But I have a feeling that if one of your friends came to you and said, hey, I'm about to lose my driver's license, do you think you could, you know, work a little spell for me?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You do it instantly. And that's the thing that I'm saying is, like, I think that there are people who, when they go into their dormancy period, they're still a witch.
Yes, I definitely agree.
They're just inactive. They're sort of on reserve duty. And when they get called up, they will perform.
Right.
And so I think there's some value to that.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay, so these hot and cold spells, are they a good thing or a bad thing? Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
A little from column A, a little from column B. I would say 60-40 bad. The hot and cold spells, I think, mostly are bad because they're so hard to get out of. Not because it's inherently bad to have a cold spell, but because breaking that rut is harder than fake it till you make it. That's my personal experience with it. That's not true for everybody.
I would totally agree with that, though. Yeah. I mean, in my experience as well.
So if you get into a rut of, I don't want to practice, or not even I don't want to practice, but like, I want to practice, but I'm going to watch this instead on TV. But if you get into the habit of not doing a spiritual, or I keep saying spiritual, even just magical practice.
Right.
It's so hard to start back up again.
I agree. So.
What about you? What do you think? Good or bad? Because I think there is some good to be added. 40% good.
Yeah, I would say more good, personally. Because it is like a recharging of your batteries, which, you know, a lot of people need. It is, like, going back to the transitioning. If you go, you know, straight from one thing to another, it's, I don't know, I can just see that being really difficult. Seeing, as I've never done that, I can just, it's almost like my brain would go into overload and it just wouldn't be pleasant.
And I mean, especially with transitioning, I can totally understand the cold period. I get that because that really is that sort of, you need to use the worn out cliche, that is the caterpillar becoming the butterfly. You're going into this pupal phase of your practice, and I get that. My worry for myself would be if I stopped practicing at all, it would be really, I know myself well enough to know that if I stopped doing what I do on a regular basis, I probably wouldn't start up again for a long time, and it would feel like there was something missing for me.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's that calling that we've talked about.
Oh yeah.
That sort of calls you back every time.
Yeah, and then there's that whole other side of it that, you know, there are some pretty powerful entities that you make contact with in doing magic, and you ignore them for long enough, they'll make sure that you know that you've ignored them for a long time. They start poking at you.
Right. So, let's talk about how to get out of a hot or cold spell. What are some things you can do?
My first impulse is to simply say, practice. Fake it till you make it. That's my approach for myself. I'm not saying that's right for everybody, because a lot of people, if they're doing something and they don't feel it all the way down to the bottoms of their toes, to the tips of their hair, it's not only not going to work for them, it's going to make them miserable.
Right.
And I get that. That's understandable.
Yeah, but if my heart's not in it, then it's just, there's no point even doing it.
Right. So it makes you feel emptier for having done it.
Right. So I sort of, you know, and it makes me just blah. So that it's almost like this cycle with me, because I think to myself, oh, you know, I don't really feel like doing anything. But at the same time, I really want to. Mm-hmm. And then, so I'll think, well, maybe I should just get up and do something. Mm-hmm. But then I'll think, well, knowing my heart's not going to be in it, what's the point? And it's, you know, it's a cycle that goes around and around until, for me, I would have to, or the advice I would give would be to change something that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, buy a new book or Google it, you know, just Google something interesting and see if you can find like a forum or something that you can read. Just anything to spark your interest again. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think a lot of the reason why we go into a cult spell is like what you were saying, is that you're kind of done, or you've plateaued.
Yes.
Which I think is a good way to think of it. Instead of, you know, going uphill.
Yeah, you're like not peaking, you were. You're plateauing.
Right. Yeah. It's just this, you know, flat line for a while. Find something to spark your interest again and to get you going uphill in your your learnings and your practice again.
Yeah, and
because one thing I learned about witchcraft is that you're always learning. You're always finding something new to do. You're mm-hmm. always, you know, no one knows everything about witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And I love that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point to make. And along those lines, I would say, yes, find something to spark your interest. Make it something you're not, do something different right. to spark your interest. If you've been using a lot of 101 Llewellyn style Wicca books, that's fine. That's fine. Find something else. Mm-hmm. Find, you know, go to a book of children's stories on witches. Mm-hmm. Look to that. If you've sort of plateaued on tarot cards, find a completely different system of divination.
Right, like just scrying, palmistry.
Yes. Something as weird as you can possibly make right. it. It's totally, you know, if it, reading the patterns in bread at bakeries, I don't care. Do something that is totally out of your, not comfort zone, but out of your box.
Yes.
I will almost guarantee you that you have a renewed interest within a very short period of time.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
So, are there any other pieces of advice you could give for how to get out of a cold spell?
No, I mean, fake it till you make it. I probably should explain a little bit what that is. That is just practice, do spells, you know, make sure that they're a reasonable goal. But, you know, there's nobody, I would think, listening to this that couldn't use a little extra prosperity in their life. So do some prosperity spells. Do some health maintenance spells. Find, you know, heck, if you really, really want to practice and you're drawn to healing, go and get, you know, go to a, look at a nursing home or you know, figure out who's sick in your community and start doing little healing spells for them. You know, do something to help other people. Think of it as a community service right. as a witch.
Right. You know? I mean, you could volunteer at a hospital or, you know, anything like that.
And then the people that you meet, you can sit there and you can do magic for them. You can, you know, maybe even not even doing magic, maybe just meeting them is going to spark that interest.
Right. For some people, that may not work for others. I don't think that would necessarily work for me, mm-hmm. but I don't really see myself as a healer, and I've never really felt drawn to that type of magic.
Right.
But that's not to say that other people don't. So.
Right. But I mean, there are so many people in your life that need help.
Right.
Find them, you know, listen to what they have to say. That's a big part of it. Listen to what other people are saying. Every time you hear a problem, think, how could I solve that magically?
Right.
Go do it. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily, you know, I know that there's definitely this sense of you should believe to make it work. But there's also the sense of sometimes you just got to do the work and let the work do the believing for you.
Do its job.
Yeah. Go out there, you know, do your spell, be done with it, and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And again, I will almost guarantee you if you do something like that, as soon as you start seeing a result, it's going to make you go, oh, I did that. Or did I do that?
Right.
And then you'll go and you'll look at the spell and you'll think about it some more. Maybe you'll say, well, I'm going to try again and experiment with another spell. And I have such a strong conviction in magic anyway that I believe that in most situations you're going to see some result. And even if it's not the result you intended, mm-hmm. you're going to be thinking about it a lot more and it'll start to pull you out and make you do more.
Right.
But that's, again, it's my opinion. What about you? What any final thoughts on how to get out?
No, I guess not. We've pretty much touched on everything that, you know, that I have done or would do. Mm-hmm. How about meeting people? you know, find a new group, like, in your community.
Absolutely.
Because meeting you, uh-huh. it was unintentional, but it definitely sparked a, whoa, you know, hot mm-hmm. spell in my practice. Yes. So.
And with that, I will make one small admonition. It's fine to meet people on the internet. Don't meet people on the internet that you're only going to know on the internet, because it's hard to know if you're getting legitimate information from them sometimes.
Yeah.
It's fine to have the online friends and to, you know, if those people do spark your interest. The forums are fine, things like that.
Well, but, what I was meaning is people to actually practice with. I think it's really right. hard to form, like, a yes. virtual circle.
Yes, the whole Second Life coven thing just weirds me out, man. I'm like, that's, I can kind of see how that works, but it doesn't gel with me. There's something inherently physical about witchcraft.
Right.
So if you're going to meet people online, make sure that they're, you know, people that you'd be comfortable meeting with in person, and hopefully will meet with in person at some point. So, but yeah, meeting people, very good way to pull yourself out of a rut.
Yeah. Okay, I guess that's it.
All right, so now you know how to get out of your cold spell, and we've told you everything we could possibly tell you.
Yeah, and if you have a recommendation or something that we didn't touch on, or a reason why you think you go into a hot or cold spell, then let us know. We'll be interested to hear your thoughts.
Absolutely. That's you can let us know at compassandkey@gmail.com.
Or comment on the blog at newworldwitchery.wordpress.com.
All right. And we're going to take a little break here, and on the other side, we're going to have a fun little story for you. So stay tuned.
Do you have Celtic roots? Are your ancestors from Ireland or Scotland or Wales? From Cornwall, Brittany, the Isle of Man or Gaul? Do you love stories and tales? Ancient myths, legends and folklore of the Celtic peoples? Do you want to hear more about King Arthur, Gwydion, Taliesin, Cuchulain, wild magic and the realms of the Otherworld? Do you want to hear about the old gods, druids and fairies in a way that they're not just dusty, dry words on a page? Then you need the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com.
Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Young Goodman Brown came forth at sunset into the street of Salem Village, but put his head back after crossing the threshold to exchange a parting kiss with his young wife, and Faith, as she was aptly named, thrust her own pretty head into the street, letting the wind play with the pink ribbons of her cap while she called to Goodman Brown.
"Dearest heart," whispered she softly and rather sadly when her lips were close to his ear, "prithee put off your journey until sunrise and sleep in your own bed tonight. A lone woman is troubled with such dreams and such thoughts that she's afeard of herself sometimes. Pray tarry with me this night, dear husband, of all nights in the year."
"My love and my faith," replied young Goodman Brown, "of all nights in the year, this one night must I tarry away from thee. My journey, as thou callest it, forth and back again, must needs be done twixt now and sunrise." "What, my sweet, pretty wife, dost thou doubt me already, and we but 3 months married?"
"Then God bless you," said Faith, with the pink ribbons, "and may you find all well when you come back."
"Amen," cried Goodman Brown. "Say thy prayers, dear Faith, and go to bed at dusk, and no harm will come to thee." So they parted, and the young man pursued his way until, being about to turn the corner by the meeting house, he looked back and saw the head of Faith still peeping after him with a melancholy air, in spite of her pink ribbons. "Poor little Faith," thought he, for his heart smote him. "What a wretch am I to leave her on such an errand. She talks of dreams, too, methought, as she spoke there was trouble in her face, as if a dream had warned her what work is to be done tonight. But no, no, 'twould have killed her to think it. Well, she's a blessed angel on earth, and after this one night I'll cling to her skirts and I'll follow her to heaven." With this excellent resolve for the future, Goodman Brown felt himself justified in making more haste on his present evil purpose. He had taken a dreary road darkened by all the gloomiest trees of the forest, which barely stood aside to let the narrow path creep through, and closed immediately behind. It was all as lonely as could be, and there was this peculiarity in such a solitude that the traveler knows not who may be concealed by the innumerable trunks and the thick boughs overhead, so that with lonely footsteps he may yet be passing through an unseen multitude. There may be a devilish Indian behind every tree, said Goodman Brown to himself. And he glanced fearfully behind him as he added, What if the devil himself should be at my very elbow? His head being turned back, he passed a crook of the road, and, looking forward again, beheld the figure of a man, in grave and decent attire, seated at the foot of an old tree. He arose at Goodman Brown's approach, and walked onward side by side with him. "You are late, Goodman Brown," said he. "The clock of the Old South was striking as I came through Boston, and that is a full 15 minutes agone."
"Faith kept me back a while," replied the young man with a tremor in his voice, caused by the sudden appearance of his companion, though not wholly unexpected. It was now deep dusk in the forest, and deepest in that part of it where these two were journeying. As nearly as could be discerned, the second traveller was about 50 years old, apparently in the same rank of life as Goodman Brown, and being a considerable resemblance to him, though perhaps more in expression than features. Still, they might have been taken for father and son, and yet, though the elder person was simply clad as the younger, and as simple in manner, too, he had an indescribable air of one who knew the world, and one who would not have felt abashed at the governor's dinner table, or in King William's court, were it possible that his affairs should call him thither. But the only thing about him that could be fixed upon as remarkable was his staff, which bore the likeness of a great black snake, so curiously wrought that it might almost be seen to twist and wriggle itself like a living serpent. This, of course, must have been an ocular deception, assisted by the uncertain light. "Come, Goodman Brown," cried a fellow traveller, "this is a dull pace for the beginning of a journey. Take my staff if you are so soon weary." "Friend," said the other, exchanging his slow pace for a full stop, "having kept covenant by meeting thee here, it is my purpose now to return whence I came. I have scruples touching the matter thou wottest of."
"Sayest thou so?" replied he of the serpent, smiling apart. "Let us walk on, nevertheless, reasoning as we go. And if I convince thee not, thou shalt turn back. We are but a little way in the forest yet."
"Too far, too far," exclaimed the good man, unconsciously resuming his walk. "My father never went into the woods on such an errand, nor his father before him. We have been a race of honest men and good Christians since the days of the martyrs. And shall I be the first of the name Brown that ever took this path and kept—"
"Such good company thou wouldst stay," observed the elder person, interpreting his pause.
"Well said, Goodman Brown. I have been as well acquainted with your family as with ever a one among the Puritans, and that's no trifle to say. I helped your grandfather, the constable, when he lashed the Quaker woman so smartly through the streets of Salem, and it was I that brought your father a pitch-pine knot, kindled at my own hearth, to set fire to an Indian village in King Philip's war. They were my good friends both, and many a pleasant walk have we had along this path and returned merrily after midnight. I would fain be friends with you for their sake."
"If it be as thou sayest," replied Goodman Brown, "I marvel that they never spoke of these matters. Or verily, I marvel not, seeing that the least rumor of the sort would have driven them from New England. We are a people of prayer and good works to boot, and abide no such wickedness."
"Wickedness or not," said the fellow traveller with the twisted staff, "I have a very general acquaintance here in New England. The deacons of many a church have drunk the communion wine with me. The selectmen of divers towns make me their chairman, and a majority of the great and general council are firm supporters of my interest. The governor and I, too, but these are state secrets."
"Can this be so?" cried Goodman Brown, with a stare of amazement at his undisturbed companion. "Howbeit, I have nothing to do with the governor and council. They have their own ways, and are no rule for a simple husbandman like me. But were I to go on with thee, how should I meet the eye of that good old man on minister at Salem village? Oh, his voice would make me tremble both Sabbath day and lecture day."
Thus far the elder traveller had listened with due gravity, but now burst into a fit of irrepressible mirth, shaking himself so violently that his snake-like staff actually seemed to wriggle in sympathy. "Ha!" shouted he again and again, then composing himself, Well, go on, Goodman Brown, go on, but prithee, don't kill me with laughing. Well, then, to end the matter at once, said Goodman Brown, considerably nettled, there is my wife, Faith. It would break her dear little heart, and I'd rather break my own. Nay, if that be the case, answered the other, e'en go on thy ways, Goodman Brown. I would not for 20 old women like the one hobbling before us, that Faith should come to any harm. As he spoke, he pointed his staff at a female figure on the path, in whom Goodman Brown recognized a very pious and exemplary dame, who had taught him his catechism in his youth, and was still his moral and spiritual adviser, jointly with the minister and with Deacon Gookin. A marvel, truly, that Goody Cloyse should be so far in the wilderness at nightfall, said he, but with your leave, friend, I shall take a cut through the woods until we have left this Christian woman behind. Being a stranger to you, she might ask whom I was consorting with and whither I was going. Be it so, said his fellow traveller, betake you to the woods and let me keep the path. Accordingly, the young man turned aside, but took care to watch his companion, who advanced softly along the road until he had come within a staff's length of the old dame. She, meanwhile, was making the best of her way with singular speed for so aged a woman, mumbling some indistinct words, a prayer, doubtless, as she went. The traveller put forth his staff and touched her withered neck with what seemed the serpent's tail.
The devil! Screamed the pious old lady.
Then the Goody Cloyse knows her old friend, observed the traveller, confronting her and leaning on his writhing stick.
Ah, forsooth, and it is your worship indeed, cried the good dame. Yea, truly it is, and in the very image of my old gossip, Goodman Brown, the grandfather of the silly fellow that now is. But, would your worship believe it, my broomstick hath strangely disappeared, stolen, as I suspect, by that unhanged witch, Goody Corey, and that, too, when I was all anointed with the juice of smallage and cinquefoil and wolfsbane.
Mingled with the fine wheat and the fat of a newborn babe, said the shape of old Goodman Brown.
Ah, your worship knows the recipe, cried the old lady, cackling aloud. So as I was saying, being all ready for the meeting and no horse to ride on, I made up my mind to foot it, for they tell me there is a nice young man to be taken into communion tonight. But now your good worship will lend me your arm, and we shall be there in a twinkling.
That can hardly be, answered her friend. I may not spare you my arm, Goody Cloyse, but here is my staff, if you will. So saying, he threw it down at her feet, where, perhaps, it assumed life, being one of the rods which its owner had formerly lent to the Egyptian magi. Of this fact, however, Goodman Brown could not take cognizance. He had cast his eyes up in astonishment, and looking down again, beheld neither Goody Cloyse nor the serpentine staff, but his fellow traveller alone, who waited for him as calmly as if nothing had happened. That old woman taught me my catechism, said the young man, and there was a world of meaning in that simple comment. They continued to walk onward, where the elder traveller exhorted his companion to make good speed and persevere the path, discoursing so aptly that his argument seemed rather to spring up in the bosom of his auditor than to be suggested by himself. As they went, he plucked a branch of a maple to serve for a walking stick and began to strip it of the twigs and little boughs, which were wet with the evening dew. The moment his fingers touched them, they became strangely withered and dried up, as with a week's sunshine. Thus the pair proceeded, at a good free pace, until suddenly, in a gloomy hollow of the road, Goodman Brown sat himself down on the stump of a tree and refused to go any farther. "Friend," he said stubbornly, "my mind is made up. Not another step will I budge on this errand. What if a wretched old woman do choose to go to the devil when I thought she was going to heaven? Is that any reason why I should quit my dear faith and go after her?" "You will think better of this by and by," said his acquaintance composedly. "Sit here and rest yourself a while, and when you feel like moving again, there is my staff to help you along." Without more words, he threw his companion the maple stick, and was speedily out of sight, as if he had vanished into the deepening gloom. The young man sat a few moments at the roadside, applauding himself greatly, and thinking with how clear a conscience he should meet the minister in the morning walk, nor shrink from the eye of good old Deacon Gookin, and what calm sleep would be his that very night, which was to have been spent so wickedly, but so purely and sweetly now in the arms of Faith. Amidst these pleasant and praiseworthy meditations, Goodman Brown heard the tramp of horses along the road, and deemed it advisable to conceal himself within the verge of the forest, conscious of the guilty purpose that had brought him thither, though now so happily turned from it. On came the hoof tramps and the voices of the riders, two grave old voices conversing soberly as they drew near. These mingled sounds appeared to pass along the road, within a few yards of the young man's hiding place, but, owing, doubtless, to the depth of the gloom of that particular spot, neither the travellers nor their steeds were visible. Though their figures brushed the small boughs by the wayside, it could not be seen that they intercepted, even for a moment, the faint gleam from the strip of bright sky athwart which they must have passed. Goodman Brown alternately crouched and stood up on tiptoe, pulling aside the branches and thrusting forth his head as far as he durst without discerning so much as a shadow. It vexed him the more, because he could have sworn, were such a thing possible, that he recognized the voices of the minister and Deacon Gookin, jogging along quietly as they were wont to do when bound to some ordination or ecclesiastical council. While yet within hearing, one of the riders stopped to pluck a switch.
"Of the two, reverend sir," said the voice like the deacon's, "I had rather miss an ordination dinner than tonight's meeting. They tell me that some of our community are to be here from Falmouth and beyond, and others from Connecticut and Rhode Island, besides several of the Indian powwows, who, after their fashion, know almost as much deviltry as the best of us. Moreover, there is a goodly young woman to be taken into communion."
"Mighty well, Deacon Gookin," replied the solemn old tones of the minister. "Spur up, or we shall be late. Nothing can be done, you know, until I get on the ground." The hooves clattered again, and the voices, talking so strangely in the empty air, passed on through the forest, where no church had been gathered, or solitary Christian prayed. Whither, then, could these holy men be journeying so deep in the heathen wilderness? Young Goodman Brown caught hold of a tree for support, being ready to sink down on the ground, faint and overburdened with the heavy sickness of his heart. He looked up to the sky, doubting whether there really was a heaven above him, yet there was the blue arch, and the stars brightening in it. "With heaven above and faith below, I will yet stand firm against the devil," cried Goodman Brown, while he still gazed upward into the deep arch of the firmament, and had lifted his hands to pray. A cloud, though no wind was stirring, hurried across the zenith and hid the brightening stars. The blue was still visible, except directly overhead, where this black mass of cloud was sweeping swiftly northward. Aloft in the air, as if from the depths of the cloud, came a confused and doubtful sound of voices. Once the listener fancied that he could distinguish the accents of townspeople of his own, men and women, both pious and ungodly, many of whom he had met at the communion table, and had seen others rioting at the tavern. The next moment, so indistinct were the sounds, he doubted whether he had heard aught but the murmur of the old forest, whispering without a wind. Then came a stronger swell of those familiar tones, heard daily in the sunshine at the Salem village, but never until now from a cloud of night. There was one voice of a young woman uttering lamentations, yet with an uncertain sorrow, and entreating for some favor which perhaps it would grieve her to obtain. And all the unseen multitude, both saints and sinners, seemed to encourage her onward. "Faith!" cried Goodman Brown in a voice of agony and desperation. And the echoes of the forest mocked him, crying, "Faith! Faith!" as if bewildered wretches were seeking her all through the wilderness. The cry of grief, rage, and terror was yet piercing the night when the unhappy husband held his breath for a response. There was a scream, drowned immediately in a louder murmur of voices, fading into far-off laughter as the dark cloud swept away, leaving the clear and silent sky above Goodman Brown. But something fluttered lightly down through the air and caught on the branch of a tree. The young man seized it and beheld a pink ribbon. "My faith is gone," cried he after one stupefied moment. "There is no good on earth, and sin is but a name. Come, devil, for to thee this world is given." And, maddened with despair, so that he laughed loud and long, did Goodman Brown grasp the staff and set forth again, at such a rate that he seemed to fly along the forest path rather than to walk or run. The road grew wilder and drearier and more faintly traced, and vanished at length, leaving him in the heart of the dark wilderness, still rushing onward with the instinct that guides mortal man to evil. The whole forest was peopled with frightful sounds, the creaking of the trees, the howling of the wild beasts, and the yell of the Indians, while sometimes the wind tolled like a distant church bell and sometimes gave a broad roar around the traveller, as if all nature were laughing him to scorn. but he was himself the chief horror of the scene, and shrank not from its other horrors. "Ha, ha, ha," roared Goodman Brown when the wind laughed at him. "Let us hear which will laugh loudest. Think not to frighten me with your deviltry. Come, witch, come, wizard, come, Indian powwow, come, devil himself. And here comes Goodman Brown. You may as well fear him as he fear you." In truth, all through the haunted forest there could be nothing more frightful than the figure of Goodman Brown. On he flew amid among the black pines, brandishing his staff with frenzied gestures, now giving vent to an inspiration of horrid blasphemy, and now shouting forth such laughter as set all the echoes of the forest laughing like demons around him. The fiend in his own shape is less hideous than when he rages in the breast of man. Thus sped the demonic on his course, until quivering among the trees, he saw a red light before him, as when the felled trunks and branches of a clearing have been set on fire and throw up their lurid blaze against the sky at the hour of midnight. He paused in a lull of the tempest that had driven him onward, and heard the swell of what seemed to him rolling solemnly from the distance with the weight of many voices. He knew the tune. It was familiar, one in the choir of the village meeting house. The verse died heavily away and was lengthened by a chorus, not of human voices, but of all the sounds of the benighted wilderness pealing in awful harmony together. Goodman Brown cried out, and his cry was lost to his own ear by its unison with the cry of the desert. In the interval of silence, he stole forward until the light glared full upon his eyes. At one extremity of an open space, hemmed in by the dark wall of the forest, arose a rock bearing some rude natural resemblance either to an altar or a pulpit, and surrounded by four blazing pines, their tops aflame, their stems untouched, like candles at an evening meeting. The mass of foliage that had overgrown the summit of the rock was all on fire, blazing high into the night and fitfully illuminating the whole field. Each pendant twig and leafy festoon was in a blaze. As the red light rose and fell, the numerous congregation alternately shone forth, then disappeared in shadow, and again grew, as it were, out of the darkness, peopling the heart of the solitary woods at once. "A grave and dark-clad company," quoth Goodman Brown. In truth, they were such. Among them, quivering to and fro between the gloom and splendor, appeared faces that would be seen the next day at council board of the province, and others which, Sabbath after Sabbath, looked devoutly heavenward and benignantly over the crowded pews from the holiest pulpits in the land. Some affirmed the lady of the governor was there. At least there were high dames well known to her, and wives of honored husbands, and widows, a great multitude, and ancient maidens, all of excellent repute, and fair young girls, who trembled lest their mothers should espy them. Either the sudden gleams of light flashing over the obscure field bedazzled Goodman Brown, or he recognized a score of the church members of Salem Village, famous for their especial sanctity. Good old Deacon Gookin had arrived, and waited at the skirts of that venerable saint, his reverend pastor. But irreverently consorting with these grave, reputable, and pious people, the elders of the church, these chaste dames and dewy virgins, there were men of dissolute lives and women of spotted fame, wretches given over to all mean and filthy vice, and suspected even of horrid crimes. It was strange to see that the good shrank not from the wicked, nor were the sinners abashed by the saints. Scattered also amongst their pale-faced enemies were the Indian priests or powwows, who had often scared their native forest with more hideous incantations than any known to English witchcraft. But where is Faith? Thought Goodman Brown. And as hope came into his heart, he trembled. Another verse of the hymn arose, a slow and mournful strain, such as pious love, but joined to words which expressed all that our nature can conceive of sin, and darkly hinted at far more. Unfathomable to mere mortals is the lore of fiends. Verse after verse was sung, and still the chorus of the desert swelled between like the deepest tone of a mighty organ. And with the final peal of that dreadful anthem there came a sound as if the roaring of the wind, the rushing streams, the howling beasts, and every other voice of the unconcerted wilderness were mingling and according with the voice of guilty man in homage to the Prince of All. The four blazing pines threw up a loftier flame and obscurely discovered shapes and visages of horror on the smoke wreaths above the impious assembly. At the same moment, the fire on the rock shot redly forth and formed a glowing arch above its base, where now appeared a figure. With reverence be it spoken, that figure bore no slight similitude, both in garb and manner, to some grave divine of the New England churches. "Bring forth the converts," cried a voice that echoed through the field and rolled into the forest. At the word, Goodman Brown stepped forth from the shadow of the trees and approached the congregation, with whom he felt a loathful brotherhood by the sympathy of all that was wicked in his heart. He could have well nigh sworn that the shape of his own dead father beckoned him to advance, looking downward from a smoke wreath, while a woman with dim features of despair threw out her hand to warn him back. Was it his mother? But he had no power to retreat one step, nor to resist, even in thought, when the minister and good old Deacon Gookin seized his arms and led him to the blazing rock. Thither came also the slender form of a veiled female led between Goody Cloyce, that pious teacher of the catechism, and Martha Carrier, who had received the devil's promise to be queen of hell. A rampant hag was she. And there stood the proselytes beneath the canopy of fire. "Welcome, my children," said the dark figure, "to the communion of your race. Ye have found thus young your nature and your destiny. My children, look behind you." They turned, and flashing forth, as it were, in a sheet of flame, the fiend worshippers were seen. The smile of welcome gleamed darkly on every visage. "There," resumed the sable form, "are all whom ye have reverenced from youth. Ye deem them holier than yourselves, and shrank from your own sin, contrasting it with their lives of righteousness and prayerful aspirations heavenward. Yet here are they all in my worshipping assembly. This night it shall be granted you to know their secret deeds, how hoary-bearded elders of the church have whispered wanton words to the young maid of their household. How many a woman eager for widow's weeds has given her husband a drink at bedtime and let him sleep his last sleep in her bosom. How beardless youths have made haste to inherit their father's wealth. And how fair damsels, oh blush not, sweet ones, have dug little graves in the garden and bidden me, the sole guest, to an infant's funeral. By the sympathy of your human hearts for sin ye shall send out all the places, whether in church, bedchamber, street, field, or forest, where crime has been committed, and shall exult to behold the whole earth one stain of guilt, one mighty blood spot. Far more than this, it shall be yours to penetrate in every bosom the deep mystery of sin, the fountain of all wicked arts, in which inexhaustibly supplies more evil impulses than human power, than even my power at its utmost, can make manifest in deeds. And now, my children," they did so. By the blaze of the hell-kindled torches, the wretched man beheld his faith, and the wife her husband, trembling before that unhallowed altar. "Lo, there ye stand, my children," said the figure, in a deep and solemn tone, almost sad with its despairing awfulness, as if his once angelic nature could yet mourn for our miserable race. "Depending upon one another's hearts, ye had hoped that virtue were not all a dream. Now ye are undeceived. Evil is the nature of mankind. Evil must be your only happiness. Welcome again, my children, to the communion of your race." "Welcome," repeated the fiend worshippers, in one cry of despair and triumph. And there they stood, the only pair, as it seemed, who were yet hesitating on the verge of wickedness in this dark world. A basin was hollowed, naturally, in the rock. Did it contain water reddened by the lurid light? Or was it blood? Or perchance a liquid flame? Herein did the shape of evil dip his hand, and prepare to lay the mark of baptism upon their foreheads, that they might be partakers of the mystery of sin. More conscious of the secret guilt of others, both in deed and thought, than they could now be of their own. The husband cast one look at his pale wife and Faith at him. Oh, what polluted wretches would the next glance show them to each other, shuddering alike at what they disclosed and what they saw. "Faith! Faith!" cried the husband. "Look up to heaven and resist the wicked one!" Whether Faith obeyed, he knew not. Hardly had he spoken when he found himself amid calm night and solitude, listening to a roar of the wind which died heavily away through the forest. He staggered against the rock and felt it chill and damp, while a hanging twig that had been all on fire besprinkled his cheek with the coldest dew. The next morning, young Goodman Brown came slowly into the streets of Salem Village, staring around him like a bewildered man. The good old minister was taking a walk along the graveyard to get an appetite for breakfast and meditate his sermon, and bestowed a blessing as he passed on Goodman Brown. He shrank from the venerable saint as if to avoid an anathema. Old Deacon Gookin was at domestic worship, and the holy words of his prayer were heard through the open window. "What God doth a wizard pray to?" quoth Goodman Brown. Goody Cloyce, that excellent old Christian, stood in the early sunshine of her own lattice, catechizing a little girl who had brought her a pint of morning's milk. Goodman Brown snatched away the child as if from the grasp of the fiend himself. Turning the corner by the meeting house, he espied the head of Faith, with the pink ribbons, gazing anxiously forth, and bursting into such joy at the sight of him that she skipped along the street and almost kissed her husband before the whole village. But Goodman Brown looked sternly and sadly into her face and passed on without a greeting. Had Goodman Brown fallen asleep in the forest and only dreamed a wild dream of a witch meeting? Be it so, if you will. But alas, it was a dream of evil omen for Goodman Brown. A stern, a sad, a darkly meditative, a distrustful, if not a desperate man, did he become from the night of that fearful dream. On the Sabbath day, when the congregation were singing a holy psalm, he could not listen, because an anthem of sin rushed loudly upon his ear and drowned all the blessed strain. When the minister spoke from the pulpit with power and fervid eloquence, and with his hand upon the open Bible of the sacred truths of our religion, and of saint-like lives, and triumphant deaths, and of future bliss or misery unutterable, then did Goodman Brown turn pale, dreading lest the roof should thunder down upon the grey blasphemer and his hearers. Often, awaking suddenly at midnight, he shrank from the bosom of Faith, and at morning or eventide, when the family knelt down to prayer, he scowled and muttered to himself, and gazed sternly at his wife, and turned away. And when he had lived long, and was borne to his grave a hoary corpse, followed by Faith, an aged woman, and children and grandchildren, a goodly procession, besides neighbors not a few, they carved no hopeful verse upon his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloom.
And we're back, so we hope you enjoyed that little reading.
I apologize if I was in any way overdramatic or strange, but...
You're an actor, what do you expect?
Yeah, so...
So anyway, we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things in the story and...
Yeah, there's a lot in that story. I know that it's definitely a work of fiction, it's definitely a work of literature. Contextually, Hawthorne... was the grandson, or great-grandson, of one of the prosecutors at the Salem witch trials. So he had a good bit of guilt over his family's involvement in that, and much of his work actually reflects the sort of rejection of puritanical mentality and puritanical religious zealotry. So there's an element, there's definitely a strong element of that in the story, but there's also a lot that he was pulling, I think, from folklore, and he got a lot right.
Yeah, it was a little scary if you were paying attention.
Yeah. So what did you notice, Lane?
Well, the first thing I noticed was the almost immediate mention of the crooked path that he walked.
Mm-hmm. To get into the forest, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we use the phrase crooked path a lot now. Well, I mean, you know, some witches do. And also the path, not for, I don't know, how do I, what
it, was it exactly? It was almost like he was hedge crossing.
Yeah.
He pushed his way into the boundary of the forest, and it closed up behind him.
Yeah, so it moved a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So it was like he went from the everyday world into this dark other world. So yes. There might be something witchy in that. We're not sure.
And like you had posted on the blog, a lot of stories from that time talking about going into the woods and how that's mm-hmm. associated with the sinning side.
Yeah, it was definitely like going to your dark place.
Right, like in The Scarlet Letter, that's mm-hmm. where, you know, Hester Prynne and the preacher dude.
Yeah, they give into their fleshly urges.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and so that's definitely in there. There are also some other lovely little witchy bits in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the old woman that he encounters talks about making a potion.
Mm-hmm.
Or
a flying ointment is how
yeah,
I take it.
Yeah, that's what mm-hmm. I thought of as well. And she mentions that there is cinquefoil in it and wolfsbane. And cinquefoil, Corey and I have actually used in some in of our working. Yeah, in hoodoo. Mm-hmm. So, and it's a big hoodoo herb. So.
Oh, yeah. It's a big one for, not particularly a flying ointment kind of a thing. It's got much more of a practical, mundane kind mm-hmm. of a thing going on. But it certainly is a relevant herb. Wolfsbane, also known as aconite, is a poison herb. It's actually very highly poisonous, but there is some speculation that it would have been in medieval witches' flying ointments. Now, some of that's based on testimony from witches who are being tortured to give the recipes, so mm-hmm. take that as you will. But it's certainly, I believe that it's an alkaline or an alkaloid herb, which means that it could theoretically, if it didn't kill you, could cause you to hallucinate about flying. So there's, you know, there's something to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She also talks about how someone stole her broomstick.
Oh, yeah. that was great.
That she was going to use to fly to the dark ritual.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So instead, she used a staff.
Did you catch who stole her broomstick?
Yes, Goody Corey.
Goody Corey. That's right. I did it, people. I stole that woman's broomstick and I rode to that meeting.
You're a goodie and not a goodman.
Yeah, I take as I can get it. There's a typo in the original script.
Of course. So she uses this guy's staff, the dark traveler, the old man, or I think Hawthorne also calls him He of the Serpent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious who he's supposed to be.
Right, yeah, there's no ambiguity right. about that. But the staff itself is interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I you brought up a really good point.
Well, it immediately made me think of the Stang.
Yeah.
So
it's used to get to and from this otherworldly place.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely fits within the mold of a Stang. Now, it's not pronged that we know of.
Right, yeah, it doesn't say that. But most Stangs that I've seen, like, you know, online or like mm-hmm. a drawing or whatever, it's not usually, you know, exactly like a Y. It's not straight wood that someone has carved. It's, mm-hmm. you know, usually something someone has found where the wood is sort of twisty or mm-hmm. it, you know, zigzags a little bit. So mm-hmm. the way he describes the staff being like it seemed to twist and move,
mm-hmm.
you know, that makes sense for a Stang.
Right. And then you have the whole serpent association with right. the serpent's ability to go above ground and below. So therefore between worlds. Mm-hmm. It's certainly, and I mean, of course, and we talked about this, the whole serpent association in the garden, on the tree, with the fruit of knowledge in the Bible. That's definitely an anti-Christian thing in the Hawthorne story, you know, where he's trying to sort of, you know, needle the reader into saying, oh, you know, this is the devil. But there is something else to that. There's this other layer of, you know, he is the devil, but not necessarily Satan in some ways.
What do you mean?
He is the devil in the sense of, like, the old world, Der Teufel or Krampus of Germany, this forest figure who, you know, could be very mischievous, but also could grant a lot of blessings, grant a lot of boons.
Hmm.
And he was just sort of this, you know, this horned, hooved spirit that lived in the forest, which obviously got adopted by Christians and turned into, it got associated with Satan.
Mm-hmm.
At some point.
Let's see. What else did I notice? When Gibbon Brown finally decides he needs to get to that ritual, he grabs his staff and he seemed to fly.
Yes. So, what do you think that means?
Well, I mean, I've heard. I'm not sure how accurate this is. I mean, they didn't just use brooms mm-hmm. for, you know, flying. It was mm-hmm. rakes and
pitchforks.
Yeah, and pretty much any long stick
yeah.
type object. So you know, it's that same thing as the old woman using the staff to get there, or her broomstick. So
right, yeah. Clearly, these are special objects used to go between the worlds, or right. Between the destination.
Yeah.
The hour of midnight. There's a good bit of crossroads symbolism in here in general, mm-hmm. but that everything happens in this. I think he says he has to complete his task between sunset and sunrise, and the halfway point there, not literally, but figuratively, is midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this crossroads association there.
Well, and, you know, a lot of people think of it as the witching hour, mm-hmm. so I don't really know what that would necessarily mean.
Well, definitely was an hour of witching. So. when he finally gets to the altar.
Right, yeah, there are four lit pines around it. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like, you know, the corners, kind
right,
of.
Right, and that ceremonial magic of, you know, having the four directions. The four.
Marked out, yeah.
So there's definitely that, too.
And I think he actually compares them to candles.
Oh, he does. But now he compares them to church candles, but it's interesting that he makes point to say that there's four of them.
Mm-hmm.
And these four candles at places, these four burning torches at specific places.
Mm-hmm.
In sort of addition to the wolf's bane and all that, there's a description of some herbs as
widow's weeds.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was a really cool way to put it. Mm-hmm. You know, for baneful herbs that, you know, would turn a woman into a widow if she were to give it to her husband. Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting.
Was
yeah.
That was a great little moment. Yeah. So it's just a lot in this story, a lot you can really pull out of it for a piece of work that was written, I think, in the earlier part of the 1800s, I think 1825 or 1835. So yeah, there's this definite already sense of magical presence on American soil. And clearly there's some, you know, good inherited lore. Most of this seems to be from European mm-hmm. traditions, but that would make sense.
Well, he even says something about British witchcraft.
Yeah, he does. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, really? They were talking about this then?
Yeah. And I mean, the context has certainly changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, clearly Nathaniel Hawthorne, if you would, you know, talk to him about a stang, probably wouldn't have known what you meant. But if you talked about, you know, a magical staff, well, you might have known that.
Well, I wonder when the term stang came about.
I don't know. I'll have to look into that.
I mean, is it like a newer thing? Is it?
No, I mean, I think it's been around for a long time, even as a word. But again, I'm not sure. We'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so there's a lot in there. There's a lot in a lot of these old stories that you can find that's very, very witchy and a lot of fun to unpack.
Yeah.
When we were reading through this, Lane and I were going through it, and she just kept, like, every time we came to certain parts of the story, she'd perk up and grab her pen and write a couple notes. So yeah, I mean, really, if you listen attentively to these kind of things, you can get a lot out of them mm-hmm. if you're a witch. So.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you were saying, if you take out the evil parts, like the, mm-hmm. I guess the devil in that story is mm-hmm. is talking about, then it's pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little freaky.
Yeah, it's bizarre how much feels right in that story. And you know, if you take out the evil, which is really his social commentary on Puritan religious zealotry, the folklore side of it is mm-hmm. very, very accurate.
Right.
In a lot of ways. So yeah.
I like that it's still recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, like, it hasn't changed so much that it's like, what are they talking about?
Right.
It makes me feel validated in that we're doing something old.
Right.
You know?
But something that is old, it doesn't have to be this, it's not lineaged in the sense of there's this initiatory line necessarily mm-hmm. going back, but it's lineaged in the sense of there's precedent for everything.
That
you look back and you go, oh, you know, this person who is writing from a completely non-practicing witch standpoint, we think, knew this much. So it's there. It's easy to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just pay attention, I think.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yep. So, that's our episode.
Yeah, we hope you enjoyed it. This probably is a little long, too, but that's okay. I hope it's okay. Hope you've enjoyed that. We will talk to you next time. If you'd like to contact us, please feel free to either drop by our blog at http://newworldwitchery.wordpress.com.
Or you can email us at compassandkey@gmail.com.
And we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, this has been New World Witchery. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
And be well.
Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Corey from New World Witchery with a special announcement. We're holding our first ever contest, and we'd like you to enter. We're looking for weather lore from your local region or your family tradition. You can stop by our blog for more details, but the overall gist of it is this. Please submit any weather lore you have to either the blog via comment or to our email address at compassandkey@gmail.com by midnight on February 28th. One grand prize winner will be selected to receive a copy of Catherine Ironwood's Hoodoo Urban Root Magic. This is the essential tome on conjure herbalism, so if you have any interest in that, you definitely should enter. We will hope to hear from you soon, and good luck.
New World Witchery is recorded using GarageBand on Mac. The song you're listening to is Homebound by the artist Jag from Cypress Grove Blues. It can be found on magnatune.com. Magnatune, your source for PodSafe music. Thanks for listening.